Good morning. So last time we started talking about programming with multiple threads in one process. We have sneakily already been doing multi-threaded programming with fork, but in the kind of more traditional use of threads, we have several threads that share an address space, and this means that they can share global variables, they can have pointers to each other's data, and because it's all the same address space, that just works. We don't have a copy for each process like we do with fork. We have multiple threads where all the memory is shared, the registers are not shared. And we looked at the POSIX API for implementing threads. So in that API, we created threads with this p3create function. This was less confusing than our fork function. It just started a particular function that would run in a new thread. When that function returns, the thread goes away. But it doesn't really go away. We have a way of collecting the return value of the thread, just like with processes, we had a way of collecting the exit status. And this is pthreadJoin, which doubles as our way of waiting for a thread to finish. And we look at several examples of how we pass values to and from threads, which wasn't entirely obvious because we had to use this prototype for thread functions where they took in a void star argument and returned a void star. And it's not immediately clear how to use that to pass values, which we use in typical C programs, which typically aren't void stars. And one thing we mentioned is that we don't actually need to use, the argument and return value for a lot of our information passing. We can, because we have shared memory, have pointers to data that's allocated elsewhere and have the threads use that. And very often, that will be our minimal use of these void stars, is that we won't be passing around sort of actual data in there. We'll allocate some memory somewhere, or possibly even have some memory that's just like on our stack and pass a pointer to the thread. Or we can even have things in global variables, though, that's not great coding stuff. And when we finished up, we talked about the synchronization problem, which is going to be our main topic for today. So we'll revisit that in a bit. So questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so a brief note on the quiz. On question two, the question was a little weird because I should have not done J plus equals 4. It doesn't affect the answer. It just makes the code a little redundant. Also, on Q4, there was an impossible, in the information above the actual sort of question part of the question, there was an impossible correspondence in virtual physical address because, of course, we have to keep the page offset the same, and I didn't do that, but it didn't actually affect the main question part of the question, which is probably why people checking over the quiz missed this, because it didn't affect the answer, but we dropped it anyways. And also another logistical note, so the lab this week, which some people have started, is the OpenMP lab. And in this lab, we're going to show you, only in lab, a kind of easier-ish to use threading API that's focused on parallelism. So it's focused on doing one problem, one big task in multiple threads, usually for performance reasons. In that lab, you're going to kind of take an operation, which is a geometric mean, and you're going to parallelize it using the OpenMP tools, which are for the most part, a bunch friendlier than the pthreads tools, primarily because they have a bunch of compiler integration, because they're specialized for this doing parallel task idea. And I guess in the lab, I note that we say that we have to split the task into what we call a map step, which is sort of do an operation on each value in a list. list, and a reduce step, which is consolidate all the results of individual operations. And the lab requires you to do strategies for both. You're not going to get an answer if you don't do both of them, which is hopefully is clear in the lab, right? But I'm emphasizing it because it's been a problem in the past. Right, that we're gonna that the original code does an operation in each element list and adds them together. For doing that in multiple threads, we need to handle both. Like, how do we do the operation on each element across multiple threads? And then how do we get all the threads' results all together? Some questions on the lab tomorrow? Okay. So when we finished up last time, we were thinking about, we had our hypothetical example of ATM server, where we're basically running multiple threads, they're processing these requests, and occasionally we might get two people who have a joint account depositing to this account at the same time from different locations. And in that case, our deposit function has this increment. That's just one statement, so it looks like, well, of course, you know, we're going to increment the balance once, or add to the balance once, add to the balance again, and we'll add to the balance twice. And the problem is that, well, even if we only have a single core, this is often not going to be implemented as just one operation. It's going to have multiple steps to actually run. And in this example, those multiple steps are separate assembly instructions. And a way a compiler might compile this is that we move the account balance from memory into a temporary register, we add to the temporary register and move it back into memory. And if we do this in both threads, we can have some unlucky timing here where thread A loads the temporary value, and before thread A writes back its result, thread B loads a temporary value. Then thread A writes back its result, thread B writes back its result, and it turns out that thread A's increment to the balance doesn't do anything. It just gets overwritten by thread B's calculation, which doesn't take into account anything thread A's doing. So if our balance was, say, 100 initially, and thread A's amount is 50, and say thread B's amount is 200, then, well, we're going to have thread A is going to compute 150 into its RAX. Thread B is going to compute 300 into its RAX. We're going to write 150 to the balance, then we're going to write 300 to the balance, but we really should be writing 350 to the balance. And this timing might seem like very suspicious. Like, when I say, what, are we really going to context switch after just two instructions? And I have kind of two answers to that concern. So one answer is that we're also going to think of this with multiple cores, in which case this sort of interleaving is pretty likely. And even on a single core, we can get situations like this. Probably what's really happening on a single core, if we get a situation like this, is that here we have like the OS handling I/O, and also like here and here. And that's why so few instructions have a chance to run, is that in between them, there's lots of other stuff the OS needs to do that's urgent. And that's how we can have this even happen on a single core in real scenarios. And it's rare, but boy, is that not the type of bug you want to make if you're dealing with financial stuff, is that every once in a while, you won't be able to figure out why, and you won't be able to reproduce it, but we're going to lose some money. Yeah, not a good look. But as I said, with multiple cores, this is going to happen, kind of, this interleaving is going to be likely. So, to start thinking about what should be happening when we have multiple threads manipulating values? Let's go through some scenarios here. So here, let's say I have X and Y are going to be two variables that we're storing in memory, some shared memory between thread A and thread B. And I run thread A and thread B at the same time. What result do we expect here? And yes, this is supposed to be the simple case, so it's not supposed to be complicated. So let's talk about what should X be? So who thinks 0 is a possible value of X after these finish? 1 is a possible value of X. Okay. So we all kind of agree that, it looks like this must be 1. Thread B can't do anything. I note that we're kind of making assumptions here that, X and Y are stored separately and that we're not doing something like putting them in one integer, together. And this seems kind of intuitive. Let's get to a more interesting case. So now I have X and Y initially 0. I have thread A and thread B. Right. Again, the question is again, what are possible values of X? So I'll give you a minute to try to figure out what are all the possible values. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who can give me one possible value of X? Any one of them. Yeah. 1. Okay. And how do you get that?
If thread A runs before thread B, then X or Y would be 0.
Okay. Yeah, so we run thread A first, and then we run thread B. So you're saying, yeah. Okay, another possible value? Or, yeah. 5, how do you get that?
If thread B runs before thread A, thread B would set Y to 4, and then thread A would add 1.
If thread B runs entirely before thread A, okay. And yeah, 3. And how do you get that?
2 over 1, but then 3 runs
off. So we run 2, like this order. Any other possibilities? No one came with anything else? Okay, we'll go right back. Okay. So, how about this case? What are possibilities X? If someone give me one possibility. Yeah. 1, how do we get that?
We run thread B before thread A.
Another possibility? Yeah. 2, how do we get that?
Thread B runs after thread A.
Thread B runs after thread A. Okay. Any others? Okay. So that's kind of our standard possibilities. Side proposal, why don't we get 3? Numbers have multiple parts. So maybe we, rewrite bit 0 of X in B, set it to 0, because that's how 2 is written. Then we write bit 0 of X in A, and bit zero, what, 1 of x and a, and then we write bit 1 of x and b. Like, when I was back here, everyone assumed x and y were stored separately, so why not the bits of them? And I think most people's intuition is that this seems pretty inconvenient. And I can ask a similar question for this scenario. Why don't we get 7? If we're writing the value, depending on when we write the bits. And probably our intuition for why this doesn't happen is that we've learned that operations on memory don't happen a bit at a time. And that's why we assume this isn't possible. On the other hand, we know that we often deal with multi-byte values in memory, and we can access memory a byte at a time, so do they happen a byte at a time? Do they happen, 64 bits at a time? This is a question which, we could have different answers to. And ultimately what we need to happen is we need whoever is designing our machine to tell us what is actually a single operation that is what we'll call atomic. What is something that happens all at once as far as we're concerned? Like physically, it probably doesn't happen all at once because the bits are physically separate. But it's set up such that when we're storing 2 to x, either 2 gets entirely stored to x or it doesn't. We don't have an in-between we can observe. And so we call this idea of something which kind of sort of happens or doesn't happen, we don't have an in-between state, an atomic operation. And you really need to know from your hardware designer what is actually atomic. And they'll have to tell you because it depends on like how our cache is built, how our memory is built, what's actually going to be atomic. On most machines, loading and storing at time aligned words is atomic. So words is kind of the natural data size of the machine. So on our 64-bit processor, 64 bits. And by aligned, I mean they're at a multiple of their size, so we don't have to worry about them being across cache blocks. If they're across cache blocks, often even if it's the natural size, it won't be atomic. And this is the rule that our processor designer is going to tell us that lets us know that running x set to 1 and x set to 2 in parallel won't result in 3. And that particular scenario probably would be true regardless, but there's something very similar which wouldn't on many real machines if we had unaligned words, because we'd have half of the two halves of n that are in different cache blocks actually written separately. And we could get that type of interleaving I showed you. And you might say, okay, so if loading and storing words is atomic, surely what I can think of is if it's an assembly instruction, it's atomic, because that's how we've been reasoning about things so far, is that I looked here and I said, I'm going to see how the instructions are interleaved, right? And on a single core, this makes sense, because the way we actually execute instructions is we have to switch between the two processes. We can only do that after one instruction finishes and the OS gets to run. We can't half execute an instruction and then go to the OS. When an exception happens, we're at a particular instruction. So the instruction started and didn't finish, the processor has to undo the instruction and run the OS, or finish the instruction and run the OS. But we don't actually have that restriction when we have multiple cores running in parallel. And this means that there are individual instructions we commonly use which are not atomic, and this will really show up on a multi-core system. And I mentioned the storing and loading values that cross cache blocks. So if we have two different cores storing a value across two cache blocks, we might get a weird interleaved result, because that store is actually done with multiple steps, multiple writes to caches. This also occurs with some complex instructions, like adding a constant to a memory location. So some of you might have been thinking, when you looked here, gosh, you know, wouldn't 3 fix this if we just did add amount, you know, if we just like move the amount to RAX, and then you happen to know there's an assembly instruction that adds RAX to a memory location. You know, it wouldn't actually be written like this in assembly. We'd have to like specify the memory location, but we can do that in x86 assembly. There's a way of doing an add to a location in memory. But it turns out that that's, you know, internally implemented in multiple steps, so it's not atomic. If we have adds running on multiple cores or an add and something else running on multiple cores, we can notice that the add takes multiple steps internally. And as an example of this, here I have a program where I have a global variable called the value. And I'm doing an add to memory as one instruction to add one to it. And I have this loop I've written in assembly, so I know the compiler's not doing anything weird, copying things to temporary values or anything. And I'm going to start this in 2 separate threads, and I'm going to pass 1,000,000 as the number of times to run the loop. So what we kind of naively expect is I'm running the add instruction 1,000,000 times in 2 different threads, so 2,000,000 times in total, and the value starts at 0. So we'd expect 2,000,000. And I ran this a bunch of times on my desktop, and here's a histogram of the results. Our expected value, 2,000,000, is over here. And you notice pretty much never happens, or anything close to it. Instead, what we end up getting is that usually the results are around 1,000,000. So what our processor seems to be doing internally is that basically one thread does all its computations on locally and then writes the result, and we have our lost write scenario, but it's being done by the processor itself. And actually, we have weirder situations. We have situations where we get less than 1,000,000, where probably what's happening is one thread is not as far ahead. It writes a temporary, writes its value to the global variable. Another thread that's further along in the loop reads that and now falls behind. So we have all these sorts of things. And the cause of this is that, you know, this instruction here is really implemented with multiple steps in the hardware. And those steps can get interleaved with all the other, with the steps of the other processor core. This probably is impossible on a single core, but my desktop has multiple cores. So this is what I get. Questions? So we see, when we're not using atomic instructions, you know, because the thing has multiple steps, there's really non-intuitive things which happen. And also, there's something I'll talk briefly about later, which is that the processor commonly takes some optimizations with memory access ordering that make this, that are part of what's making this as bad as it is. That it turns out that even though storing a value to the cache is an atomic operation, It's not necessarily done when you think it's done. So this means that if you want to know what things are atomic and therefore safe to use, you have to have the processor designer tell you. So just because the add is one instruction doesn't mean that it's going to do what you think it think it should do if you're adding to something in one core and accessing it in another in any way. So, you need to be told. And this is kind of an unfortunate thing for us writing multi-threaded programs, because it means that we kind of have to be very careful about checking what does our system actually guarantee has a well-defined ordering. We have to check that it's documented, because if they don't document it, they probably implement it in a way where it might get us in trouble. And so here we had a problem that our add was kind of split up into pieces. There's another problem, which is that operations are moved around. And this comes from mostly compilers. So compilers usually optimize your code, assuming there's no other threats. So here, for example, I have a loop that's waiting for ready to be set, presumably by another thread, because there's nothing here that can send it. And my compiler said, okay, so what we want to do here is we want to check this variable ready in this loop. And it would be really slow to keep loading ready from memory. So why don't we first load it from memory into a temporary register just to make things faster? And then, keep it in that register for the entire loop. That's going to make things so much faster. And it does. And unfortunately, also makes the loop not do what we intended. Because now the loop is going to either finish after one iteration or be an infinite loop. It's never going to deal with another thread setting the ready variable. And this is something that the C standard says compilers are allowed to do, because they can optimize your code as if no other threads are around. And this is with a load. Another way this comes up is that here I set is waiting to 1 while I'm waiting, and set it to 0. Seems like a reasonable idea to tell some other thread that I'd like other ready to be set, please. And not only do we have the problem with other ready being stored in a temporary variable, and therefore we don't know when it gets set, we also have the problem that the compiler said, gosh, the way this function works is you set is waiting to 1, and you never look at it. And then you set it to 0. That's redundant. Why are you doing that? Let's just set it to 0. That's all we need to do. Nothing else uses it until the function returns, at least. And so my compiler conveniently just sets it to 0 and never sets it to 1. And again, it's allowed to assume there's no other threads around. This is a legal optimization according to the C standard. Yes? So if we declare all these variables as volatile, then the compiler has to do the operations at some point. So I would say for the reason we'll discuss next, which is that processors do these optimizations too, volatile is insufficient in practice. The intention of the volatile keyword is to support special accesses to the hardware, not actually to do thread synchronization. And we'll see a way where this can get you in trouble, starting with the next slide. But yes, you're right that volatile would prevent these optimizations. It doesn't help in the most intuitive way, because things that aren't volatile, the compiler can still move around. So there's a way to tell the compiler how to do these optimizations. You mentioned volatile is one way to do that, but it's still not enough, because the processor
will do this kind of reordering. Oh, and I don't have my example. But the processor will do the same kind of optimizations, and that's part of what was going on with the RAD example. Is that the processors do the same optimizations themselves, kind of dynamically, and that seems really non-intuitive. But this means that we get cases where even though, yes, the loads and stores are atomic, they're not necessarily executed in the order you expect. That the processor can move it later, saying, you know, you just, we loaded this value, we're loading this value multiple times, so let's just load it once in advance. Processors do that sort of thing internally. So what do you do as an actual normal programmer to deal with this is, you know, either you need to very carefully understand your hardware's guarantees, or more likely, you use the pthreads library, and the pthreads functions will tell the processor and the compiler, hey, this is something that's dealing with multiple threads. Please don't do any of that funky reordering stuff. Make things work the way they're supposed to intuitively by making sure that anything I do before you call this pthreads function, like pthread create, actually finishes before the pthread create runs. And the same thing with pthread join. And this is really important for our prior examples, because we really want it to be the case that, like, when we set something up with pthread create, that that's actually set up, not moved later in our function before the function runs. And pthread create, pthread join, and some other things we'll be looking at do the work to prevent this. And there's kind of two things they do. So one thing is that they tell the compiler, hey, I know you like optimizing things, but there's other threads doing stuff here. You know, make sure things are actually set in memory. Don't assume that things in memory won't change. Don't keep things in temporaries across these things. And the other part is they have to tell the processor, you know, hey, I know you like, you know, when I'm reading a global variable over and over again, I know you like to only read that once in advance. Don't do that. And there's some special instructions to do that. For example, on x86, there's an mfence instruction which says, no, really, make sure all the prior things have finished and don't start the other things until after they've finished for memory accesses. So questions about my sort of brief foray into reordering? I'm not going into like super detail because this is like one of the most complicated topics in sort of computer architecture / programming languages to really explain. There are these things called memory models where people define, well, what reordering is allowed and isn't. Because obviously, if it's just a free-for-all, that doesn't really work. We're not going to get into that. I'm just going to say things work intuitively if you have a pthread function. It just like makes sure that everything before then finishes before you go after the pthread function. And that everything after the pthread function doesn't start until the pthread function works. Okay. So given that we've learned that we can't really solve the problem we went to solve originally, our lost add problem, with just writing the add in a clever way, because the compiler and processor are kind of working against us, we're going to need help from some pthread functions. And there's a particular abstraction that we're going to get from pthreads that's going to be useful for this that we haven't seen yet. We've seen pthread create and pthread join. That doesn't really give us the tool to solve our lost write problem. So we're going to have a new abstraction that I think comes up briefly in some other classes of locks. I'm going to define some terminology. So we're going to want to get a property we call mutual exclusion, meaning ensuring that only one thread does a particular thing at a time. Our particular thing in our original example was like we have an account, only one thread should update the balance at a time. And we're going to call the code that only one thread can execute at a time a critical section. And our tool for implementing mutual exclusion, for making some piece of code into a critical section, is going to be something we call a lock. And this is an object that only one thread can hold at a time. And based on the name lock, you might assume that the way we should kind of explain locks by analogies is that we should compare it to like a lock, padlock on a shed or something like that. And I think that is a bad analogy, so I will be avoiding using it. And the reason I think it's a bad analogy is that our locks are going to be generally advisory, meaning that unlike our padlock on the shed, there's nothing that's going to stop you from doing the equivalent of going into the shed. You know, the only thing that's going to stop you is you agreeing that you do something. So my analogy is that we're going to make an agreement that we want to make sure only one person changes the account balance at a time. So we're going to have a rule, a very just arbitrary rule, that before I change the account balance, I need to put on the hat. If I don't have the hat on, I'm not allowed to change the account balance. That's just a silly rule, and we made this silly rule because this is going to ensure, because there's only one hat, that only one person can change the account balance at a time. And if someone else wants to have the hat, well, they have to wait for the other person to take it off. So our lock is going to be like our hat. We're going to have a lock or acquire operation, which is put on the hat. And according to our rule, that says I have permission to change the account balance. There's nothing actually enforcing that rule other than us having the discipline that I put on the hat before I change the account balance. If I forget to do that, the account balance is still going to change. But I'm just going to have a rule that I put on the hat, then I edit the account balance, then I remove the hat. And anyone else who does things with the account balance does the same. But this only works because I enforce this policy that is doing something entirely unconnected to the account balance, kind of inherently. The only reason it's attached to the account balance is because I made an arbitrary decision. And I made that decision because if everyone follows that rule, we'll have sort of mutual exclusion for accessing the account balance. Only one thread at a time will do that. But importantly, and the reason I'm not using the lock analogy, this is not something that's going to be inherently enforced. It is super easy to edit the account balance without putting on the hat. The reason why that's going to be useful is because we're going to carefully have discipline in writing our code that we won't do that. So that gives us our lock primitive here. So this is the tool we're going to use to implement vernal sections, and despite the name, it's not going to actually stop us from accessing things, except that we're going to follow the convention that I always acquire or lock the lock before doing something, and I always release or unlock the lock after I'm done. And so, you know, our code for accessing the account is we have a lock for accessing the account, we acquire that lock, then we do things with the balance, then we unlock that lock. And the way this acquire operation works is that we're not going to do something where if I have the, you know, I have my hat on and you want it, you're not going to grab it off my head. Now you're going to wait patiently for me to put it down. So the acquire or lock operation is wait for the lock to be free. And if that means waiting forever, that means waiting forever. And then get it. And the release operation, let others use the lock, and this should make anyone waiting on the walk be able to make progress. Questions? And you'll note that I say, when we unlock, we wake up waiters. Because ideally, the way our lock's going to work is that when you're waiting for the lock, that just like when you're like waiting for a key press, you're not going to be using the processor. This requires some help from the OS. But ideally, when you're waiting for a lock for a while, the OS will instead run some other threads or processes. And we won't waste processor time, you know, checking for the lock. You know, with our head analogy, I'm not going to just stare at, we're not going to have the, you know, a core just checking the lock, checking is that lock available, you know, or for my hat, checking is the hat still on the head. We're going to do something else and then get back to it and be notified when it's available somehow. That's the ideal implementation. We're not going to talk about much about strategies for implementing this, but a big reason why we want to use the lock interface is that this is going to mean when we're waiting, it's going to be efficient, hopefully, if it's the lock is implemented well. So we talked about this lock interface, and we've been using the pthreads library. So what is the pthread lock interface? Pthread actually has a few different locks. The main one you should use is called mutex. Mutex just stands for mutual exclusion. But it's just a quote-unquote normal lock. And so it's represented by a pthread mutex t. We need to initialize that. You can do that with this init function or the special pthread mutex initializer constant. We have this argument here that's attributes for the lock. So there's some settings you can set for a mutex. We're mostly not going to set them, but they're somewhat useful. And once we've made one, we can lock and unlock it, potentially from multiple different threads. And also, the lock has a return value, just like create does. I'm just not checking it for brevity on this slide. Some questions? Okay. So now that we've seen locks, I have some code here where I'm setting some strings, 1 and 2. And my question is, if we run these two threads as different threads, we pthread create twice, create thread A and thread B, what are the possible final values of the variables 1 and 2, the global variables 1 and 2. Give you a couple minutes. Yeah, and obviously there are multiple possible values. I think two of them are easy, and the others are harder.
Okay. Who'd like some more time? Okay, most people. I have, as a preview, I have a table of all the values we could assign to one or two, and we'll just see which of combinations are possible. So, who can, I have my table, I like to fill in which of these are actually possible or impossible. Someone give me some entry I can fill in as either possible or impossible. Some of these are easy. Okay, yeah.
One in A, I think two in A is possible.
Okay, so we're saying that one in A and two in A is possible. And how do you get that?
If thread B runs first, and then all the locks are available, and then thread A runs,
Yeah, so we can run thread B, then run thread A, and we can always, with locks, have these situations where it's uncontended, where we're already taking turns without the locks, so the locks don't do anything. There's no case where we have one thread holding a lock while the other wins. Okay. Any other things I can fill into my table? Yeah. Okay, where thread A runs first, and what do we got? So I think we still have a couple easy ways, pieces I can fill in on my table. Others, people want to volunteer? Yeah.
One in B.
Okay, one in B and two in A. And how do we get that? So thread A runs first. Okay. So we run A1. And then thread B runs. And then we run thread 2. And this is consistent with our locks because we as long as thread B waits until after we unlock lock 1, which it's going to have to, then it can run its whole thing. And once it locks lock 2, actually, we can't, thread A can't make progress yet anyways. Or, yeah. any other entries in the table I can fill in. I have a whole bunch, and so that was not one of the easy ones. There are some easy ones left. The really trivial ones. Sure. So let's talk about this one. Can I end up having 1 and 2 not change? People are shaking their head. Can someone give me an explanation? Why can't that happen? Yeah. Okay, you think there's no situation 1 and 3 are not going to change in both threads? Okay, so I think the thing we have to watch out for, which is a topic we haven't gotten to yet, is can this lock operation ever wait forever? Because as long as both of these threads terminate, it's clear that we will have assigned a value which is not init1 and init2. And I will assert that this is, in fact, not possible. And a way we can prove that in this case is if we look at thread A, we have to acquire lock 1 here. And the question, and I would say, in thread A, like there's two places where we can possibly wait, and those are the locks of lock 1 and lock 2. Those are the only operations which ever wait for anything. So as long as those don't wait forever, thread A will terminate. And therefore, we'll run both of the assignments in thread A at some point. And the only thing which could interfere with lock 1 being set forever is thread B. And thread B, yes, it can hold lock 1, but when it holds lock 1, thread A is waiting. And assuming that thread A and B are the only things using these locks, then that means that thread B can always keep going because it's never going to wait on lock 2 because thread A isn't doing anything with it and no other thread is. So we can't wait here. And the same is going to be true for lock 2, that the only way we could be waiting on it is if thread B is holding the lock, but if it does, it's going to release it right away and we'll get to go. And so that means all these possibilities where we have the init value are not possible. And also kind of an assumption is the threads both finish. As long as the threads have a chance to finish, those are not possible. So then we have one more, 1 and A, 2 and B. So who thinks that is not possible? Thinks that is possible? No clue? Okay, so we seem to have consensus that that's not possible. Can someone tell me how can I prove that it's not possible? Hopefully someone hasn't gone, but we'll take either. Yeah. Okay, so your argument is that we start at A and we set 1 in thread A, so because our goal is to have 1 in thread A persist, then there's a problem that it will always be overwritten by B. And if we start in B, then we're going to set both 1 and 2 before we have a chance to set 1. Yeah. And I guess a way which might be more systematic, we can kind of think about the same thing. Is that for this to happen, we need to run B1 before A1. And we also need to run A2 before B2. And we also know that we need to run that this code here means that A1 needs to run before
A2. Because of how the code for thread A is written, we can't do that in the other order, which is that's how the code works. Does A1, then A2. And so we have kind of our total order is that we have to have B1, then A1, then A2, then B2. But this isn't possible because we know that we always hold the lock from B1 through B2, so A1 cannot fit in between those two. Yeah.
So if we try to lock a lock that's already been set by another thread, does that just wait?
If we try to lock a lock that's set by another thread, does that just wait? Yes. And yeah, just waits. Other questions? Yeah, and as we'll learn when we talk about deadlock, which is probably Thursday, it will wait as long as it needs to, possibly forever. Other questions? Okay. So this is a no. Okay. So and I have some alternate versions of that exercise. So something I'd like to know about how pthread mutex works is you have to unlock from the same thread you locked in. And the reason I'm mentioning this is that some of you might say, you know, I want to do something where locks aren't the right fit. I want to like wait for something to be true. And you might say, oh, this idea, what I can do is I can lock a lock and have someone else try to lock the lock and to signal that the thing became true, I unlock it. So they wait for an event. This is a great idea. It doesn't work with pthread mutex locks because they have this rule that you have to unlock from the same thread you lock in. So later we'll talk about a way of doing a big feature of we want to wait for something to happen. Right, that is not something that locks support well. They support, taking turns well. They don't support, waiting for something to happen. An example is if you want to do something like pthread join, right, you want to wait for a thread to finish, there's not a good way of doing that with locks. There's some hacks that kind of work, but not a good way. So we're going to talk about some a more general tool of monitors. We probably won't have time this semester to talk about semaphores. And we'll talk about a less general tool called barriers probably today. And I promise when we talk about them, we'll have a good answer to the how do I wait for something to happen question when we talk about monitors. Something I'd like to mention that it's not a good idea, is that technically locks give you all the tools that we need to, wait for a flag to be true. So here's my while not ready loop written with locks, and I set ready by using the lock to make sure it happens at the right time and I'm not confused by anything. This kind of has two problems. So one problem is that it, just wastes processor time doing this. The other problem is that we don't actually have a guarantee that mark ready can run, because we can, in practice even, end up with scenarios where because we're unlocking and locking right away, there's no time when the lock is free that's long enough for mark ready to run, depending on how the locks are implemented. So don't do this, even though it's tempting. We're going to have a better mechanism we'll talk about probably next week that's going to let us solve this problem without wasting a ton of processor time and without having the issue that, you know, this lock might never actually get the lock back here because someone, you know, who often the way the lock will work internally is whoever calls lock first gets it. And that if we just unlocked it, will almost always be us if we relock it right away. Okay, so questions on our locks. Okay, so let's talk a little about barriers. And barriers are a kind of special synchronization tool that's going to be more specialized than locks. And that's going to come up on a future assignment. And they're kind of meant for a pattern which comes up all the time in parallelism. So you remember, parallelism is what I said is what we call when we have one problem we're trying to solve but split up across multiple threads to take advantage of extra hardware. So for example, let's say I want to compute the minimum of 100 million element array. The way I might do this is I might split it into two, compute the minimum of the two 50 million element pieces, wait for those two computations to finish, and then take the minimum of my two partial results. And this wait for all the computations to finish operation is something you want to do in a nice way. And note that, like, I like this to work out such that if I change this 2 to, like, 100 and change this 50, therefore, to 1 million, I like to still be able to do that. So we're going to talk about barriers as a mechanism to solve this kind of, I want to wait for a whole bunch of computations to finish, and I want something that works nicely no matter how many of them I have. Because if I have two CPUs or 100, you know, we're going to use the same interface. And a barrier is going to conceptually provide two operations. So we're going to have our initialize operations, which is going to take a parameter, which is the number of threads that we're going to have doing computation. And then each of the threads will call this wait operation. And in all the threads, the wait operation won't return until every single thread has called wait. So all the threads will wait for all the other threads. Questions about motivation for barriers? So kind of in our initial example here, I have my two threads computing the partial minimums, and then I put them together. A way I could implement this with barriers is I initialize a barrier saying I want two threads total, and I compute my partial minimums in two threads I have running, and after that, I have one of the threads. I arbitrarily chose thread index 0, but you know, didn't have to. Now use everyone's minimums to compute the final value. Questions? Yes.
Would you run initialize before you create all the threads?
Would I run initialize before I create all the threads? Doesn't matter if it's before I create all the threads, but it definitely needs to be before barrier wait is called. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Now, you might say, okay, well, this seems useful for thread 0, but it doesn't really matter that thread 1 is waiting for everything. Why do we have barriers work this way? And that's because kind of the classic thing which comes up in a lot of parallel computations is that we actually have multiple computation steps. So kind of a classic example is something like a weather simulation. We're going to divide up our world into a grid, and for each grid cell, we're going to have one processor computing what the weather is like in that grid cell. And to do that, they need to know about the weather in all the surrounding grid cells.
And we don't just do this once. We actually want to do this like over a full day. So we might say divide the day up into 15-minute increments and use the weather in the past 15 minutes to estimate the predicted weather for the next 15 minutes. And to do this, this means we want to wait for everyone to compute the past 15 minutes before we compute the next ones, because we need all the surrounding information. And barriers are really designed for that type of simulation use case. So in this example here, I have a results array, which is results time cell. So this is something like my weather simulation. I compute my results by looking at all the past weather, not just in my cell, but in all the cells. And then I estimate what's my estimated weather in the next time step for my cell. And I'm doing this in two separate threads. And this means I have these dependencies between threads that go in kind of all directions. That thread 0 computes a result that thread 1 needs to use. And you know, thread 1 computes a result thread 0 needs to use, but thread 0 also computes a result that in the next time step, after the next set of weights, thread 1 needs to use. And barriers support this use case in kind of two ways. So one is that we saw that when we do the wait operation, everyone waits for everyone else. So in this example, after the first wait here, we have our thread 0 knows that thread 1 has computed the value it needs, and thread 1 knows that thread 0 has computed the value it needs. But the other way is that we can call wait multiple times, and it waits an additional time for every thread. So we can kind of synchronize over and over again with this one sort of abstract object. Questions? What our barrier does. Again, we have sort of another instance of this pattern. Everyone needs to wait for everyone else. Okay. So barriers, I've shown you kind of an abstract API. They exist in pthreads. I would note that they exist on Linux and pthreads. OS X, for some reason, does not implement them. And they take some attributes, which we won't look at, but they take a number of threads, like we've seen, and we have a wait operation you can call in every thread. Questions. So since we've seen barriers, let's do a little exercise here. What is the output of this code, assuming I run these two threads at the same time, and I initialize the barrier for two threads before I start the threads? And if you think the output might have multiple possibilities, also think about that.
who'd like some more time? So who can give me one possible output? Any volunteers? One possible output. Yeah. 50, 30. And how did you get that?
So x is set to 20 initially, and then y is set to 10 initially.
Okay.
And then we run y equals x plus y. And then y is 30.
Okay.
And then we run x equals x plus y, which sets x to 50.
Okay.
And then we print the results.
Sets x to 30, 10, 30, 50. Yeah. Yeah, and I think that is the only possible result because the barriers in this case are sufficient to ensure we don't have any cases where we have two threads modifying X or Y at the same time. Questions? This. Yeah.
So it's not possible for the two weights in thread two to just like reduce the barrier to get past it?
It's not possible for the two weights to sort of get consolidated in any way? No. So each weight needs to wait for all threads to call weight. Yeah, so weight is one nice, so pthread barrier weight like is a nice way, if you want to have a bunch of threads that kind of work in lockstep, is exactly the tool for that. And okay, so that's where I'll finish up today. So next time we'll talk briefly preview the upcoming threading homework and then talk about deadlock.